Spirit of life-giving love and love-giving life. Spirit of a sunny winter day, glimmering off of the fresh snow. Spirit of beauty all around us, be with us as we come here to seek and find our ways together, as we seek to find healing for those things that have injured or harmed us, those things that make us sick, sick in our hearts or sick in our bodies. Be with us as we reach out to one another in compassion and in understanding. Be with us as we strive to find and make meaning in our lives that might make those meanings all the more fulfilled and fulfilling. Be with us as we endeavor to live our lives with such an integrity that we can know what our needs are and seek to fill them, but at the same time see beyond those needs to the needs of the world around us. And in being so blessed, may we be grateful. Let us hold this moment together in quiet. Amen.
Our ancient reading this morning is chapter 1 from the Tao Te Ching, The Way by Lao Tzu. The way that can be experienced is not true. The world that can be constructed is not real. The way manifests all that happens and may happen. The world represents all that exists and may exist. To experience without generalization is to sense the world. To experience with generalization is to know the world. These two experiences are indistinguishable. Their construction differs, but their effect is the same. Beyond the gate of experience flows the way, which is ever greater and more subtle than the world. Our modern reading is from Thomas Paine, 18th century philosopher, American founding father, and revolutionary. I do not believe in the creed professed by the Jewish church, by the Roman church, by the Greek church, by the Turkish church, by the Protestant church, nor by any church that I know of. My own mind is my own church. All national institutions of churches, whether Jewish, Christian, or Turkish, appear to me no other than human inventions set up to terrify and enslave mankind and monopolize power and profit. I do not mean by this declaration to condemn those who believe otherwise. They have the same right to their belief as I have to mine, but it is necessary to the happiness of man that he be mentally faithful to himself. Infidelity does not consist in believing or in disbelieving. It consists in professing to believe what he does not believe.
Time flies. Seems like, and it was, just 3 weeks ago tomorrow that my wife Judy and I arrived in the Spanish city of Sevilla. It was one of our 5 major stops on a 2-week tour of Andalusia along the Costa del Sol, the southernmost part of the Iberian Peninsula. Some of you may remember that my vacation last summer wasn't terribly vacation-like, so I was ready for a little serious or not-so-serious time off. This hit the spot perfectly. The trip was excellent, even the weather was ideal, with sunny days consistently reaching up into to the 50s all the way up into the upper 60s. Along the way, we visited Malaga, Cordoba, Granada, Tarifa, as well as Sevilla. I was musing in our adult ed class the other night that one of the things that draws me back to Europe time after time is the sense of history that's a part of every breath that you take when you're there. A permeating energy seems to come up from the ground and out of the stone and the mortar palaces, cathedrals, and the other ancient structures, as well as out of the brass and the marble monuments that seem to be everywhere. For me, it oozes up out of the ground and into my limbs, and then it just spreads throughout my being, and as it does, a sense of hope spreads with it as I physically experience the continuity of hundreds of generations and thousands of years. We have made it this way before, the visible history says to me. We've made it this way before, and look, here's evidence of those who have passed this way before us. Here's evidence that what we do while we're here does matter. That's pretty much how the whole trip was for me. Just absorbing incredible sunlight, excellent food, sumptuous wine, and the expansive narrative that was all around me all the time. That's pretty much how it went, but not completely. That wasn't my experience when, 3 weeks ago tomorrow, we arrived in Sevilla. I'd have to say that my experience there was just a little bit more like when a phonograph needle, to date myself just a bit, do all of you know what a phonograph needle is? When a phonograph needle, after gliding seamlessly through countless revolutions of an old 33 RPM, suddenly hits a glitch in the groove between the ridges and goes bouncing in a discordant and harsh Sevilla, as I'm sure many of you know, is one of the grandest cities in all of Spain, let alone the jewel of Andalusia. Among its magnificent buildings is the Alcazar, the 10th century palace built for the governors of the then Moorish Islamic State. The Alcazar is often considered second only to the Alhambra, just a little ways, a few kilometers over in Granada, as an example of excellence in European Moorish architecture, but from my perspective and experience, both of those places were just utterly phenomenal. Sevilla is also home to one of the most incredible Catholic cathedrals in all of Europe, Santa Maria de la Sede. It's the third largest church in all of Europe, following only behind St. Peter's at the Vatican and St. Paul's in London. And it's the largest Gothic church anywhere in the world. The patron saint of travelers, many of you know this person, the patron saint of travelers, Rick Steves, known to many who are familiar with his work, wrote of Sevilla. How many of you know Rick Steves' work? If you don't, you should, if you travel at all. Rick Steves wrote, "When they ripped down a mosque of brick on this site in 1401, the Reconquista Christians bragged, 'We'll build a cathedral so huge that anyone who sees it will take us for madmen.' And then they proceeded to build that cathedral over the next 120 years. It doesn't matter from what direction a person approaches the cathedral, from any viewpoint, its steep spires and titanic towers, its dramatic domes and arabesque archways are strikingly apparent. It's nearly impossible to capture the grandeur of this building with mere words. On our initial approach to it, we mistook the exit at the rear of the cathedral for the main entrance. Just a couple of rubes from the U.S., I suppose. Not only had we come to the back door, but our arrival coincided with the end of that day's visitors' hours. It was late in the afternoon of the first of our 3 days that we'd have in Sevilla, so it was no big deal. We'd come back the next day. But before we left to explore another part of the city, though, we sat down on a nearby ledge in the warm Spanish sunshine with our Rick Steves tour book to read about Santa Maria de la Sede. We wanted to be better prepared for our visit when we did return. That's when the metaphorical phonograph needle hit the rather monumental glitch on the album of historical reassurances. What we learned was that during the Spanish Inquisition of the late 15th century, just there in a courtyard of the cathedral, literally a few feet in front of where we were sitting, over 4,000 Jews had been brutally slaughtered at the hands of those Reconquista Christians. Jewish men and women, children, even infants were put to brutal, bloody deaths. In the same courtyard and adjacent neighborhoods, untold thousands of Moors, had met their fates in similar bloodbaths, I was sickened by the shocking realization of what had occurred in that space that was just before me, and I knew at once, I felt it at once. I was not going to go into that cathedral. I could not go into that cathedral. My mind was flooded with thoughts. It struck me that just a couple of countries away in other parts of Europe, there were other places where millions of Jews and others had been put to death, in Dachau, in Auschwitz, in Treblinka, to name a few of those places. There, though, there are plaques and memorials to remind everyone of the heinous brutality that took place at those sites. In Sevilla, at Santa Maria de la Sede, there wasn't a single word posted in memory of the thousands upon thousands of innocents that had been slaughtered there. Not a word. There were only signs indicating gates and fees and praise for the magnificent cathedral, which now was beginning to seem to me an arrogant expression of a barbarous episode in history wrapped in a veneer of piety for the Madonna and her infant son. It's incredible to note that prior to the cathedral's construction, prior to the Inquisition, there were there in Sevilla, and in many other places, but in Sevilla, in that exact neighborhood, there were Jewish and Catholic and Islamic communities that lived together in harmony for hundreds of years, for centuries, with no problems. You might remember that I was raised Roman Catholic. I left that religious tradition in my youth for two primary reasons. First was, as my intelligence and reason and curiosity and spiritual sensibilities evolved, I could no longer hold as tenable those theological tenets that demanded a personal infidelity to everything that I was learning through my experiences in the world. And second, I left because I felt that the ecclesiastical structures of the church had lost touch with the universal values that I'd thought the church had been created to maintain in the first place. I was angry in those years. I was pretty sure that if Jesus had been around when I was a youth, that he'd be angry too. Jesus wasn't all about Jesus. Jesus was all about love your neighbor. In the intervening years, my theology has grown still further and further away from those dogmas that I'd been taught to abide and to fear, but also since then, quite different from that growing away, I've managed to let go of much of that anger that I felt toward the church. It became okay with me that the ecclesiastical structures, which I found to be ponderous at best, those ecclesiastical structures were meaningful to millions of people around the world, and that was just fine. I found that I just didn't need to be angry about that anymore. And then there I was again, sitting outside of the once blood-filled courtyard of Santa Maria de la Sede. And after the initial reaction of nausea, I found myself feeling angry at the disdain and the pride of the institution and of a culture that claimed to be the religious expression of the Prince of Peace. By failing to even acknowledge the sins of the place in any way, it seemed to me that the church and the culture had lost track of any aspiration for peace and for the practice of loving one's neighbor, and instead had come to be inured in the attempt at self-righteous control of others. Because they had terrorized and mostly eliminated anyone in opposition to their dominance, there was hardly a still small voice around anymore saying, love your neighbor, love even your enemy. It's sadly ironic that the faithful of these three religious traditions, Christianity and Islam and Judaism, move from living peaceably in their Mediterranean community during the Dark Ages to ever-increasing hostilities in our world today. The Catholic Church once dominated the Western world by way of the Roman conquest and the Crusades, and finally the Inquisition, not to mention their missionary invasion and conquest of the Americas. Through time, though, their military prowess has ebbed, and along with it, so has their moral authority. Much of that is not a result of the ebb of their physical power, but as a result of a class of Catholics who can now read the scriptures for themselves and make their own determinations. And another factor, I think, is the ongoing and ever more difficult history of scandal suffered by the church. And at the same time, the once victimized Jews and Muslims have grown in an ardency of the faithful. And simultaneously, both groups have grown in military prowess. Jews have done so primarily, I think, as a means of seeking security for the state of Israel, however guided or misguided their actions might be. And Muslims have done so, and quite ironically, in what appears to be an effort that's very much like that of the medieval Catholic Church to convert the world through jihad to Islam. Of course, there are all kinds of sectarian issues in that mix, but that is the stated purpose of the fastest growing branches of Islam, to convert the world. It was impossible for me to keep thoughts like these from running through my mind as we sat there, now in the lengthening shadows of the spires of the cathedral, and I found myself thinking about the evolution of religion itself, particularly those three religions that occupy a great deal of religious airspace as well as ink in the headlines of our media. I found myself wondering, how do some religious ideologies take root and others not so much? I found myself wondering how a guy already ancient in years sired a pair of sons through two different women who went on to become the patriarchs of two out of three of those monogamous religions, and I wondered how and why people were willing to attribute to these and kindred patriarchs some sort of special relationship with a deity who was more of a superhuman than he was a force of creativity, a deity who gave the patriarchs dominion over the tradition. How does that happen? I don't know how that happens. And I found myself wondering how a Hebrew revolutionary in the Roman Empire, an outlaw, was put to death and was then redeemed by the adoration of his disciples, and who was once again lifted up by the conviction of his having a special relationship to a superhuman-like God. Not just a relationship, this one though, but actually was somehow a part of that God. And again, how did others gain control after his death of his ministries in ways that have interpreted and misinterpreted that ministry to the masses throughout history? How did that happen? How does this sort of thing happen? How do those religions become arbiters of history, not just of a nation, but of an entire civilization? How can it happen time after time? How can it happen when these three traditions are seemingly able to at times abandon the core of their principal values and still maintain the allegiance of their ardent faithfuls? I don't know how that happens, only that it does. I'm not here to judge anyone else's beliefs. I don't know how it works, but I don't have to know in order to accept that that is how other people understand the world, how other people understand the universe. I don't need to judge anyone else's beliefs unless those beliefs inspire people, encourage them to see themselves as especially human in ways that do harm to others in the defense or promotion of those beliefs or for any other reason. When that occurs, I think it is our obligation, perhaps our religious obligation, to judge by calling people, even entire faith communities, to be accountable for any discrepancies that exist between the morality of their religious tenets and any reasonable understanding of what an ethical world requires. If our religion condones us treating those who are outside of it in ways that are less affirming and promoting than are those inside of it, then our religion, any religion, fails to meet a basic human standard of religious value in a world that is coming apart at the seams. And that is what is happening to our world as it is reduced technologically, as the boundaries and borders between various peoples, various cultures, various religions, those borders and boundaries disappear. There are far too many religionists around the world calling for crusades and inquisitions from far too many quarters. Such heinous onslaughts are no longer a local issue. The future of the world, to a very significant extent, hangs in the balance of religious tolerance. Contemporary poet and essayist Kathleen Norris writes, "What religious conversion is not, if it serves us a bit too well, if it reinforces all of our prejudices and allows us to call ourselves holy at the expense of others whom we can now judge to be unholy, it's probably not the real thing," she writes. When religions fail to be religious, it's up to the rest of us to hold them accountable, just as it is up to them to hold us accountable for the synchronicity between our morals and ethics for the world. A primary purpose for religion ought to be the gathering, the ingathering of people into a community of faith. It ought to provide people with a common understanding of or approach to life's most abiding questions about existence, about life, about death. A primary purpose of religion, which is a human-created social institution, ought to be to provide us with opportunities to make and find meaning in our lives through the experiences of our lives. Believe what you will, I need to know how my beliefs uphold the spirit of life and not how they give me permission to abuse it. Believe what you will, I need to know how my beliefs are integrated into some kind of eternal and universal way that is accessible to all of humanity, beyond humanity, to all of creation. I need to know how my beliefs are integrated into some kind of eternal and universal way that defies isolated interests and promotes instead the sanctity of all that is. We don't need to find the way. We simply need to find a way. Religion really ought to be about an understanding that we are all on this journey together, that we may or may not have the answers to life's most challenging questions. But if we do believe that we have those answers, if we do believe that, we also need to know that they have come out of our own earnest experience and that they may or may not in any way be applicable to another person's experience. Massacres do not accomplish that kind of understanding. Affirming and promoting the inherent worth and dignity of every person does. 20th century theologian Martin Buber, a Jew who knew something about the universality of religion, wrote, "When people come to you for help, do not turn them off with pious words saying, 'Have faith and take your troubles to God.' Act instead as though there were no God, as though there were only one person in all the world who could help, only yourself." I came away from my experience in Sevilla with the thought of how truly grateful I am to have found this faith community and this faith tradition. Rather than name a God and kill others in that God's name, we leave it to the individual to determine what is the great and mysterious cause of being. We leave it to the individual to name that cause or to not name it at all. We leave it to our community, this community of faith, to act as if there is no God, as though we are the only ones who can help. I suspect if there is a sentient deity, and my own jury is still out on this one, but if there is a sentient deity, that deity could only be appreciative of our help. And if there isn't, well, I hardly think that we're wasting our time. I came away from my experience in Sevilla grateful to be a religious heir to the great traditions that preceded us and that are still our partners along the way. But even more, I'm grateful for the prophets and the priests of liberal religion that preceded us here by saying, "We will create a religion that's based in tolerance, a religion that's based in freedom of conscience, a religion that's based in reason. We will create a religion that is filled with hope, because in it we will recognize that no one is saved unless we are all saved." Some religious ideologies take root and others not so much. It's time that we make much of what we have been given. I'm not saying that Unitarian Universalism has it all figured out. We do not. From time to time, that phonograph needle will continue to hit our glitches. But that's part of being on a journey together, isn't it? It's about figuring out the next steps in creating a world that is the expression of the beloved community. It's about holding ourselves and one another accountable for living, truly living, the values that we hold dear. I want to tell you that it was really good to get away for a couple of weeks. I had a wonderful time. But more, it's even better to be back home with you, attempting to create a history that one day, too, may be discovered in antiquity. And someone looking upon our efforts just might remark, "Oh, I'm here. My ability to be here is because they were here. We were here before them." May we set our goals for today and for our future that we might find such a way as that. Blessed be, and amen. Take courage, friends. The way is often hard, and the path is never clear. And the stakes are indeed very high. Take courage, for deep down, there is still another truth. You are not alone. And so may the prayers of our hearts and the songs of our lips shared in this holy hour of worship be with us now and in our time to come. And as we extinguish our chalice, this worship comes to an end and our service begins. Blessed be, and amen.